Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, we're coming back to a conversation that elicited a lively and insightful debate from you. Late last year, as an Associated Press analysis of racial diversity in charter schools was published, I interviewed scholar and author Noliwe Rooks. Her own research on race in charter schools concurs with what the Associated Press found, that many charter schools are racially segregated and that the academic performance in those segregated charters lags state and national achievement standards. Here's what Professor Rooks said about it.
What often happens is individual parents react to stories about the public school system as if their experience is the experience that is shared by everyone. It's absolutely true, and it has historically been true, that you can be in a single race environment and receive a great education. What the AP story makes clear, though, is that overwhelmingly, so not for those individual parents here and there who may say my experiences are different, but overwhelmingly, if you are in a heavily racially or economically segregated school, you're not getting the resources and the results are not as high.
Well, the response from you to the show was swift and varied. Emails poured in defending charters, defending Professor Rooks, and asking, how do we fix this? So that's what this show is about today. Three guests with a lot of knowledge and experience on charters. And of course, I want to hear from you. If your son or daughter attends a charter school, is that school as racially diverse as you'd like it to be? And is that charter performing at an academic level you expect? You can tweet me on that. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, I said we have a lot of experience on the roundtable. Bernadia Johnson is the former superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Carrie. I'm happy to be here.
Dan Shulman is an attorney who has argued a segregation case before the Minnesota Supreme Court. Dan, we'll talk about the case. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Brandi Burris Gallagher is the policy director for Ed Allies, and she has a lot to say about that show and Professor Rooks and the idea. Welcome, Brandi. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a blog post after my conversation with Noliwe Rooks that said you believe there wasn't enough nuance in the discussion, and I think the words you used were oversimplified and unhelpful. So we're going to spend the hour talking about this, but I'd like you to zero in specifically on what you thought was too simplistic about the conversation. What was it?
Yeah, thank you. I think when I approached this conversation, I think back to the conversations that I have with Minnesotans and parents from across the state, and they share with me, I think, where I am on the issue, that integration is important, but there are other factors that are, and sometimes more important when they're picking a school. So parents care about teacher diversity. They care about quality in the way that they define it. They care about the curriculum. They care about having a safe and affirming environment for their families. And I think it is dangerous to elevate integration to the forefront, knowing that for all families that's not the case.
But Bernadia, I think the AP report was not just elevating integration, although I hear Brandi on that, was also elevating academic performance and holding that, you know, holding the feet of the charter schools to the fire when it comes to academic performance.
Having been a superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, I took a lot of accountability and responsibility for academic achievement. So I would agree that there are some charter schools that are not making the grade and that spotlight is not on them like it should be. And yet there are some that are doing excellent by students.
Why is the spotlight not on them as it should be?
I don't know why there's this distance. In the community, the communities in which I served seem to not recognize that those segregated schools were not performing well. But what I will tell you, they don't have the same accountability in some ways, and I'm not sure that their boards are as accountable as they need to be. But what I will say is that the people who choose these schools for their children choose it for the reasons that Brandi just stated. And in fact, the question then becomes, what are we doing for those schools in Minneapolis public schools that are equally performing badly? similarly to the charter schools. So sometimes people are escaping a bad situation to go to a bad situation.
Got it.
And so what charter schools do well is they connect with parents. They're flexible. They do things to meet the needs of the students that they serve. And sometimes we're more bureaucratic and systematic, like conferences must be held during the day. Well, heck, parents work. They can't do that. And parents are looking for flexibility. They're looking for options. And quite frankly, they're looking for places that care for their kids and love their kids and not love them into failure.
Dan, the AP analysis, again, which was roundly criticized by many people, who I think, as Brandy was saying, elevate other things beyond academic performance. But the AP analysis basically makes the case for the argument that you made to the Minnesota Supreme Court, doesn't it?
Yes. I think the one of the things that we have to do here is look at this all of this from the perspective of we have an achievement gap. We have, without question, schools that are heavily segregated, both public and charter schools, and look at the history and effectiveness of desegregation and what that means and how effective it's been. And I'm, for example, in the lawsuit that we're bringing, we have as an expert a professor from Berkeley, a man named Rucker Johnson, who happens to be the son of Carol Johnson, who was the superintendent of the Minneapolis Public Schools when I brought the first of these cases in 1995. He has done a longitudinal study covering children born between 1945 and 1968, followed them through 2013, African Americans, ones who were in segregated schools and ones who were in desegregated schools. And what he found, and he said, I find that for blacks, schools desegregation significantly increased both educational and occupational attainments, college quality and adult earnings, reduced the probability of incarceration, and improved adult health status. Desegregation had no effects on whites across each of these outcomes. So that is the evidence that we need to bring to all of these discussions.
Brandy, do you think people who support a lot of the good that charter schools do are ready to hear something like that and really be willing to factor that into their perception of what these charter schools are about?
Yeah, I think before responding to that, I just really quickly want to address the charter quality question.
Sure.
Because I agree. I'm the first one to say that there are charter schools who are not performing well and underperforming for the kids who need it the most. And I think we should urgently act and intervene in those cases. But that challenge and that problem isn't unique to charter schools. There are performance concerns across school type, and I'm of the mindset that we should be focused on academic outcomes and improving student outcomes for students in a variety of schools. But at the same time, it's undeniable that there are really strong lessons learned and success stories in the charter field. And the Star Tribune has the Beating the Odds school list every year, and charter schools are well represented on that list. And so I don't want it to be lost that this is a real and an important option for families. But to the question of charters' role in integration, I think when it comes down to it for me, it's about empowering families. And so when I think about the civil rights movement, I think about power, and I think about giving power to groups who have been historically disenfranchised. And so I'm always really kind of hesitant around any solution that would take power, take choice away from families. And so I think we need to think about the options that parents have and think about making sure charter schools are meeting all parents' needs. But I would worry about taking away that option for families.
Bernardia, before I come to you, I just want to hear what Dan has to say, because you're going on the statistics to say parents might feel good about these schools, but it is undeniable that many of the charter schools are not serving their kids the way they think they are. Isn't that what you're essentially arguing?
Yes. The vast majority of charter schools are not performing well. And when we get this so-called beating the odds, there shouldn't be any odds to beat. I mean, this is about, you know, the odds are against all these kids, and but a few of them can beat the odds, or they can do it at a few schools. Now, with parent choice, I would never fault a parent for choosing the best educational alternative for that parent's child. What the problem is, there is no meaningful choice today. It is a choice between segregated public schools and segregated charter schools. That's not a meaningful choice. We need to give parents meaningful choices. That's what our lawsuit's about.
Bernadia?
Well, I'm sitting here listening to this conversation, and as I said, as a parent and as a superintendent, and the fact of the matter is, and I want to make sure I'm clear about this, I've been agnostic about school types. And you may remember that I was around this round table with Lynn Norgren, the union president, talking about trying to take some of those practices that happen in charter schools and best high-quality charter schools to implement that in what we call community schools, to give individual schools the same type of flexibility that charters have around staffing, curriculum, scheduling, and because schools know their context involving parents and teachers in doing that. So for me, the fact of the matter is that we need to make sure that all of our schools are high quality for students. And I get frustrated when I've heard from my staff that, you know, charter schools are taking the kids away and draining the system, but I don't see that equal passion and fight to let's keep them. Why are they gone? I talked to parents. I just made phone calls when I knew I was going on the show. I left the district and nobody ever called me. Now, I'm criticizing the place I used to work and was responsible for this. We have a whole department for community engagement and for student placement. And yet our priority is not on making Minneapolis a choice for our families and making them great choices. And when I heard from parents, they wanted a gift and a talented school. We couldn't pull it off. And that would have been a naturally integrated environment. And so parents left and went to Bloomington. So they're not just going to segregated charter schools. They're leaving the system in droves for programs that they believe will meet the needs of their students.
I think we should also note that it is somewhat unusual that you're a former superintendent of public schools who is agnostic on the idea of charters, right?
Sure.
I mean, this is why this is such a polarizing
issue. Absolutely. It is polarizing, and I'm probably an anomaly. but I will tell you, I have a new grandbaby, 15 months, baby Bennett.
Congrats.
I'm going to find the best school for him that will meet his social, emotional needs and his academic needs, wherever that may be, and whatever cost it will take from me.
And you hear that message from parents across the state. And that's why I think it's so important to ask families of color, parents of color, why they are sending their kids to schools that are, quote, segregated, and investigate that further.
Tell me why you put that in quotes. They are segregated.
Yeah, I guess I challenge that definition of segregation.
Tell me why.
So in my head, segregation is forced exclusion. And here, again, it's tied to parent choice and parent power. And parents are selecting these schools of their own free will. And they're doing so after research and after tough consideration, because, again, it's the best fit for their kid. And so I just have personally a hard time calling that segregation.
I want to talk about a new definition for segregation. But first, to what Brandy said, when she sees choice as the motivator, that doesn't say segregation to her.
Well, the fact is, I mean, segregation is, it isn't really, a school is either segregated or it's not. It's either if there is an imbalance one way or the other. And we have, it's not just minorities and free or reduced lunch. In the suburbs, we have white segregated charters.
Right, I was going to say. So if it's choice on the part of white parents, Brandy, somewhere, it's you're okay with that too? If it comes out being segregated, because, which it does in a number of
because things. they don't want their kids sitting in the same class with, say, black kids.
Totally. Let me be clear. I come at this conversation with an equity mindset, and so I'm thinking about protecting choice and power for underserved families who haven't had those choices historically. I think that is where our attention needs to be. And that is where my comments are coming from.
Dan?
Well, as I said before, it's not meaningful choice. And also, a lot of these kids are in the schools they're in, not because of well-informed thoughtful decisions by their parents because they're in neighborhoods that are racially segregated, because not because of anything they did, but because of decades, if not a century, of federal, state, and local government policies that have created segregation in this country.
And when you say in these schools, you mean the public schools and the charter schools?
Well, the charter school is generally not a neighborhood school, but the public schools for sure.
Okay.
And there's a new book out this year called The Color of Law, which explains, you know, the idea that these so-called ghettos are the result of choice or any natural event is a total fallacy. It's all the result of government policies refusing to guarantee FHA loans for blacks, restrictive covenants being enforced. There's a whole history of it. So a lot of these kids are in charter schools because they are the victims of these policies that put them in neighborhoods and the state has allowed, and this is a phenomenon that occurred around 2000 and after, they have allowed Minneapolis and St. Paul to revert to neighborhood schools and to organize their system that way.
Bernadette?
So Minneapolis did revert to neighborhood schools, and here's another consequence, as Dan said, the fact that the housing patterns and the laws and the federal instances of drawing boundaries different in school districts have led to segregated schools, without a doubt. And so, not to sound hypocritical, I do believe that integration has a good point. But what I take exception to is when integration is on the backs of black students. And there are segregated white schools, as Dan said. But what always bothers me is that the black students must go integrate the white schools, and the white students are not doing the reverse.
This is the choice that Brandy is talking about,
exactly.
Here, right?
So it does come like a false choice in some ways. And the fact of the matter is, years ago, and I haven't been in Minneapolis for 3 years, and even years before that, we did some research and found out that when schools become 35% free and reduced lunch, you have white flight. And there are some naturally integrated communities in Minneapolis. Lyndale is a perfect example of when we were trying to look at communities that were integrated and trying to figure out how to integrate schools in that community. And we had a group of parents who came from boroughs in that neighborhood and came over to Lyndale. And it's a really integrated environment, and it's a great little school. I would send Bennett there. But I will tell you that that's the thing. When I talk about growing up in Selma, Alabama, which is a segregated city, and you know the history, the fact of the matter is I had to be driven to a white school to integrate the schools, and white students were not asked to do the same.
And that's what happened after Brown. And I think it's so dangerous to put the onus of integration on families of color. And I worry that that's where we're headed with this lawsuit, because the named districts are districts that predominantly serve kids of color. And I agree with you. I think that's really, really dangerous.
Dan?
You know, there's a solution to white flight, which in fact exists in certain areas of the country like Raleigh-Durham.
What is it?
It's metro-wide desegregation. It is involving all of the districts in a metro area in a desegregation plan. For example, if we do that in the Twin Cities, I mean, where is the white flight going to go? Are they going to go to International Falls? Are they going to go to Duluth? There's a way to deal with that. Also, the creation of metro-wide desegregation, I mean, it's not just desegregation. There are other things. For example, magnet schools. To make the inner city areas more attractive. Also, one of the experiences with metro-wide desegregation is that resources flow from the exterior to the interior.
Meaning what?
Investment. There's more money spent. Better facilities are provided because the white parents who are seeing their children going to these schools, they want them to get the best education, which is absolutely what all parents
just
want.
Just so I understand this for a second, though, metro-wide desegregation is taking students will not be going to their neighborhood schools.
Not all of them.
For the most part, right?
Well, that's hard to, you know, One of the things that, I mean, another expert we have working with us in the case is Myron Orfield, who was at the University of Minnesota, who's devoted his entire career to this issue. He has a statistician working for him. They have devised, put together, you know, what if we could have metro-wide desegregation.
A plan for metro-wide.
Right, which shows that virtually no student is going to ride a bus any farther than the student rides a bus today.
Well, how does that sound to you, Bernadette?
Well, I will tell you, everything is consequential. We had an experiment, Dan, if you remember, with WeMap, where Minneapolis students were allowed to go to schools in the suburbs. And it certainly wasn't citywide or statewide integration. And what we found is that the students who went out there, 5 years of research showed 2 years our students perform, a matched set of peers perform better, and 2 years the students out of WeMap performed better, and 1 year was inconclusive. And I still believe that that budget item is in the commissioner's budget, so we still are busing kids out of Minneapolis to go to, quote, integrated environments. But what we found is those districts that are mostly white were sending their black kids to the places that were supposed to be integrated, and so it didn't work. In other words, the white students didn't leave the Minnetonkas to go to WeMap. It was the black kids who open enrolled into Minnetonka or through the choices yours that went to WeMap. And all I want to just posit is the fact that we have to really think these things through, and they are more nuanced, and everything is consequential. And maybe they won't ride a bus further, but the fact of the matter is I tried an experiment in Minneapolis that I'd like to share with you briefly, where we tried to integrate schools, Lake Harriet, Southwest, and Burroughs. We even moved the boundaries for 35W to get more students into boroughs. And you may remember the blow up with the school board member.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We want these kind of kids, not those kind of kids.
Right.
It's the letter I got. Okay. So let me just say that. So you go into these environments where your students are not necessarily accepted or welcome because you upset the order of things. And for one school, a student was coming from the area 14A, I think it is, from North Minneapolis going to Southwest, enjoyed being in the school, but could not participate in any extracurricular activities because her mother didn't have transportation. So integration is not just sitting next to somebody white, it's relating, it's sharing our experiences and our culture. It's not just sitting next to the person. It is like my house was in high school, United Nations, you know, kids interacting. And again, as a child growing up in Selma, Alabama, I sat next to white students I never talked to. And we go to the grocery store and we see each other and we kind of like wave, but we weren't, you know, like really doing things together. And
right.
So if we do something like that, we have to put the resources forward to make sure that our students are well served in those communities and that there's some cultural competency training. And our students who left the North area schools to go to Southwest, and I did that as an inter-district integration effort because those students were going to go to Edina. If you go to Edina, I have a white school in Minneapolis you can go to if you want to integrate. And the fact of the matter is those students didn't they didn't have the same support systems in the schools for the students who would have gotten that back in their home school. So it's not so simplistic, as you said. It's nuanced, and it takes a lot of thought. And I cannot accept or feel good about not having white people come. North High used to be an integrated school. It was a program that drew people from outside the district because of the SUMATEC program they had. Mm-hmm. So if you have quality programs, high-quality teachers, and a strong leader, I believe you can attract and keep people, but you got to listen to them.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable conversation that follows up on a show that I did late last year with Professor Noliwe Rooks about segregation and charter schools. It was the same day that this Associated Press analysis came out saying that many charter schools are racially segregated and that the academic performance in those segregated charters lags often state and national achievement standards. I heard from a lot of you, some of you defending charters, some of you wanting to know more about Professor Rook's analysis, And we thought it would be, we thought this was good, a good idea for a wider conversation here, which is what we're doing. Bernadia Johnson, probably recognize her voice here on the roundtable, former superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools. Brandy Burris Gallagher is with us. She's a policy director for Ed Allies. And Dan Shulman is with us. He's an attorney who's argued a charter segregation case before the Minnesota Supreme Court. Dan, I'll ask you to describe the case, and then we'll come back to the experiment that Bernadia was describing there with Minneapolis Public Schools.
This is a lawsuit brought on behalf of children in the Minneapolis and St. Paul's public schools against the state of Minnesota. The lawsuit claims that these children are receiving a segregated education, which is against the law in itself, and also provides an inadequate education by any objective measure. The claim is that what the state has done and allowed violates three provisions of the Minnesota State Constitution. The Education Clause, which says that the state, essentially as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, each student in Minnesota has a fundamental right to receive an adequate education. That there's also the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause. That is what the case is about. That's what we argued about
in
the Minnesota
Charters
Supreme.
Are in the mix there.
Yes, charters are an issue in the case because charters are even more segregated than public schools, and because the state has exempted charter schools from any type of desegregation rule or requirement. Charter schools, the movement began in Minnesota, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is.
But this is the only state in the United States that has made charter schools exempt from any type of desegregation rule or requirement.
So I'm interested in what you make of what Bernadia said about the experiments that she did within the Minneapolis Public School District.
Well, I will say that I agree with basically everything Bernadia said, and there are two points that I really want to stress. One is that this is a two-way street, that the whites have to participate equally in desegregating the school system and desegregating the society. Second, Bernadia used several times the term consequential to talk about the complexities of the problem. That's absolutely true. This is not a problem or a situation that developed, say, in the last 10 years, the last 20 years. This is a situation that is the result that began when the first slaves were brought to this country. It was not solved by the Civil War. It was not solved by Reconstruction. It was not solved by the New Deal. We are living with the badges, the aftermath, and use a legal term, indicia of segregation today affecting African Americans in this country. And people, they say if those who are not aware of their history are doomed to repeat it. We are repeating our history. I mean, in the political situation today, people need to appreciate the depths and long-standing nature of this problem, and we have to roll up our sleeves and try to work through it. There was an effort after Brown for a while, for about 20 years, that in fact was successful, and then there was a backlash that basically eliminated desegregation in federal courts.
Bernadia, you said something interesting, though, off air. You said that integration helps white students more than it helps students of color. Why?
Absolutely. I feel like in the community and in the society that we have today, that it's important that white students understand the diverse world in which they live. And when they go off to work and play, they will be interacting with people. And the more they're around folks that are different than them, they can share their history. I feel like they will be more successful in life, quite frankly. And that's why I take exception to it just being black kids. I will probably, hypothetical, I don't know if this is true, this is just my local and immediate, I believe that you will find more diversity in a black home or in a black environment than you will in a white one. So I could be wrong about that, but that's what I think and believe. I know that, as I said, in my home, things were really pretty integrated. But I would tell you, when my kids went off to a White House, I would come back like, how did it go? How did they treat you? You know, I wanted to know all those things because it's important to me. And the fact of the matter is that all of this, as Dan is saying, is by design. There's a design. You know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
I got it.
But
it wasn't accidental.
None of this is accidental. Right. All of this is by design. Even the setup to have these kind of conflicts around charters or DSEC, the fact of the matter is that we don't have a state, like you said, a state department that believes, or legislature that believes this, or they wouldn't be continually funding
that
students.
That believes what?
That believes that integration is important.
Really?
I don't know.
You don't think the state legislature holds that as a high priority?
No.
I feel like they say that.
I don't believe they do.
Why?
Because, and this, around 2000, prior to 2000, this state had a desegregation rule, the Department of Education, then it was Children, Families, and Learning, that allowed for metro-wide desegregation. It allowed for desegregation when there was no showing that this segregation was the result of any kind of intentional action. And the Department of Children, Families, and Learning changed the rule so that basically to make desegregation impossible, to eliminate any kind of inter-district desegregation efforts. And the legislature has not done anything about it.
It seems, Bernadia, that if you two are right, that, and I don't know how Brandy feels, Brandy, do you feel like the legislature and political leaders in the state of Minnesota do not place a priority on desegregation?
I don't know if I'm equipped to answer that, but maybe they're of my mindset, which is I personally believe that there should be a solution that provides parents integrated settings if that's what they want. And there should be settings that are also in environments that are also safe and culturally affirming. And
that means segregated charter schools.
And that means that maybe the school serves one population of student and does it well. And I think why that's important is because of the bias and the discrimination that's happening inside of schools of all types. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a ton of research that shows that for kids of color, in, you know, into more integrated settings, there are decreased teacher expectations, increased discipline removals, increased identification into special education unnecessarily. And it can't, and you know, as a little Black girl in school, I felt that. Parents are hearing about that and feeling that and seeing that with their kids, and they're aware of that, and they are considering that when they're making choices. And so it's important, in my view, to provide a variety or a diversity of options for families.
I mean, the reason I find it alarming to hear you all say that you don't think the state prioritizes true integration is with the achievement gap. It will really never be solved, will it? And that's got deep implications.
Well, is that by design as well, Carrie?
Is it?
I mean, I think,
yes.
Seriously, there will always be people who want to create an underclass or a group of folks who are not achieving.
That's right.
And I feel like at some point we have to acknowledge that and call it out. And if we don't, it will continue to repeat itself. And I agree with Brandy, there should be, choice should include integrated environments if parents want that. And I would want that for Bennett. And, you know, but if there's a segregated school that shows him the power that he has behind him, I would be there for that as well.
A few things. What Brandy said, I don't dispute it, but I don't think it's mutually exclusive that it's got to be segregated, or if a school serves a certain population, it has to be segregated.
You mean if it's a culturally affirming, I think that's the phrase
right.
you use,
yeah.
school, that it doesn't have to be
a segregated school.
Also, does it, Brandy? I think that's an important point. Can I just come back to you on that?
Yeah, I would say that there are parents who are looking for schools that have majority populations of kids that look like their children.
So, Dan, I think she is saying that's how the school.
Well, I mean, like 90%, 100%, or can we go like 30 or 40%?
Well, while you guys are bartering on that, the other thing that parents want is the fact that they want the teachers that look like their students.
Absolutely.
I'm teaching at Minnesota State Mankato now, and I'm telling you, there's some students in my class who said they've never had a teacher of color.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more.
And so that's what,
Okay, and the second point, you know, that these are solvable problems.
Right.
You know, get more teachers of color, make sure that the schools are not enforcing the discrimination, enforcing discipline discriminatorily. Because these things are obviously happening, that doesn't mean we give up and don't try to solve them because they are soluble problems. And what Bernadias said about, you know, do we want an educated underclass? No, we don't. Education is freeing. Knowledge is freedom. And is there a will in this country to educate the underclass? I don't think there is. I think that's a huge problem because they don't want to educate.
Now that I'm hearing you use the term that I said, underclass, I don't like that term.
All right.
So
minorities, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. But I want to share.
Soon will not be minority.
Right. Yeah. I want to share a story. So talking about my integration experience, my sister and I have been coming to Minneapolis for years because my grandparents lived here. And one year, we like every year, we flew up for the summer, and we get back to school, and the teacher asks, what did you do this summer? My sister says, well, I took an airplane, and I went to Minneapolis. The teacher talked to my mom and said my sister was telling tales. And she could not fathom that a little black girl from Selma, Alabama, would get on the plane and fly to Minneapolis and eat at the Curtis Hotel with cloth, tablecloths, and napkins.
Was the teacher white?
Yes. Well, yes.
Of course.
Yeah. I think I probably had two black teachers in my whole education growing up in Selma. So what I know about this is that we have to do a better job in higher ed of making sure that we're educating teachers and leaders to understand the diverse communities that they're serving. And I want to put one more point out there that I'm sure you'll be able to connect, that the other data that I saw when I was in the district is that middle-class black students were performing worse than white students in poverty. So I just want to make sure I put that data out there as well. Now, I don't know if that's still the same, but if you have middle-class families who've gone to college, who are working and understand the system and how to navigate it,
right,
their kids are performing
right
more than students in poverty, white students in poverty. There's a problem around race, too, and we can't deny that.
What does that say to you, Dan?
Well, it says, you know, what we've been talking about basically is racism. And so the question is, what do we do to try to, just to begin, to make an effort here?
I just wanted to put the word race out in the conversation, even though I think it was inferred.
Can I want to come back to something that Brandy brought up, which is this, how we define segregation and the pejorative, I think, sense that we attach to it. I was reading something that Chris Stewart, he's an advocate for charter schools, said to The Atlantic about this, and he sounds like he's arguing for a more contemporary definition of it. He says, when parents pick a culturally affirming program for their child, and they are from a historically marginalized population, like Indians or black people, that is so far from the traditional understanding of segregation that it's almost insulting to call it that. What about that, Dan?
I said before that one cannot fault a parent for making a choice for what the parent considers to be the best education for a child. The problem is the system that does not provide meaningful choices. The system that creates creates segregated schools. That is the problem. We have segregated charter schools. We have segregated public schools. There's no meaningful choice for parents in that world.
So I think the one thing that I was superintendent when he was on the school board.
Yeah.
I think when you think about the traditional definition of segregation, it's black and white. And our communities are so much more diverse now. So Dan, would you agree that when we think of that, Randy, black and white is what comes to mind?
Yes, but the real pernicious segregation here, in addition to race, is socioeconomic. Mm-hmm. It's free or reduced lunch, because that is the single highest indicator of whether there's going to be successful performance in school by children.
What do you think of that, Brandy?
I So I in my job get to talk to a lot of families and parents, and many of them are low-income families, mm-hmm. families of color. And what Chris said really resonated with what I've heard from them. I think they do see a difference between any sort of forced exclusion or separation of their children and the opportunity to send their kid to a school that is of their choosing and happens to be a school that serves majority minority population. And I think in their view, the school's doing well. And I think, you know, oftentimes, at least with charter schools, they're not setting out to serve majority minority. They're not setting out to be known as the Hmong school.
Some are, but yes.
But in many cases, right. they're not setting out to do that because of a variety of reasons. They get through parent choices, the student population that they have, and then they respond to that. And we should be celebrating that they're responding to that and that they're offering language courses and that they're offering food options that really connect and creating a school environment and setting that connects with the families that they serve.
It kind of brings us back full circle, though, to where we began, which is, okay, a parent makes a choice. The school is perceived to be culturally affirming. They offer the food choice and all. And yet they don't perform academically, or the parents really aren't aware of whether they're performing academically. You're still shortchanging that student, aren't you? That child.
I think quality is important, and I know parents define quality in a variety of ways. And an important piece of that is academic outcomes. And an important piece of that is my child going to be successful when
but it's not everything. I hear you saying.
Right. But that is, let me be clear, a very important consideration for families. And there are charter schools that are accomplishing that. And there are charter schools that aren't. And the state has a responsibility to intervene for the ones that aren't. But there are district schools that are doing really great things for kids. And there are district schools that aren't. And there are integrated district schools where the white students are doing really well. And if you disaggregate the data, the students of color are not.
Bernadia?
Well, I can't disagree with anything they both have said. I think for me, though, as I think about this discussion, I still come back to we have to make sure as institutions that we're hiring the best people and that we're making sure they're culturally competent and that we continue to do what we need to do. Because the other question that I have is about, and I will tell you, some of the schools that I know who have started up, they have started out with a special niche, like Heritage Academy. At one point, the Somali teachers were let go because they were the last in, first out. And so when you have an issue, when you're trying to diversify your staff, and they don't have the tenure to stay on, then the teachers went and started a school, and the parents followed the teacher. So teachers really matter in this conversation. And I'm going to tell you, I know that parents, and I want to go back to Dan's point because I don't want to miss that. I do feel like we haven't figured out a way to really educate and inform parents about data and information. I do know that sometimes parents will select a school based on the aspect that Brandy said earlier and may not have any idea about the academic mm-hmm. work. And the fact of the matter, that's the responsibility of the school to do that. I've had students who would go from Harvest Prep Academy, come back to Hall, go to Wise, and then go to Ascension. So they would keep going around trying to find the best fit for their kids. So you have some of that, and that's ridiculous, you know, so that becomes an issue as well. So I want to make sure I get everything out about the problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dismiss the fact that how we run our systems has an impact on it.
Dan?
Well, I agree. We've got to get everything out about the problem. One thing, however, we do know is that desegregation works. I mean, that is, you know, Rucker Johnson's study, and the thing that is really clinching to me and really stunning about this study is, you know, he says increased both educational and occupational attainments, college quality and adult earnings, reduce the probability of incarceration. That's very significant. And here's the one that just floors me, and improved adult health status. Wow. I mean, adult health status says so much about basically happiness.
The quality of your life.
Yes.
For the rest of your life, right?
So, I mean, that is That ought to seal the deal, I think. Adult health status. Wow.
Dan, you say on this, desegregation works. Nothing else does. There's no amount of money you can put into a segregated school that is going to make it equal.
That's right.
Brandy says no.
I disagree.
Bernadette and Brandy say no.
And I have examples of that. So here's the thing. You have examples and you have a study. We have examples and we've had conversations with people about this. I don't believe that you could throw money at the problem. I do believe that. And their schools get a lot of money, a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we don't see the income. So I can't disagree with that. Because, Dan, what's really important is we have to think about all the indicators. And I agree, an impoverished community, if they don't have, you know, like some of the things that other communities have, sometimes they may be put at a disadvantage. But I think that can be overcome with a great education. And I believe, and I know for a fact, that having a high-quality teacher 3 years in a row makes a big difference. And so paying attention to some of those things, as I said, in the system matter equally with the money.
Brandy, desegregation works, says Dan. Nothing else does. There's no amount of money you can put into a segregated school that's going to make it equal. And you were shaking your head through the whole thing. Why?
I guess I disagree with the two main points. I disagree that nothing else works. I don't think that research supports that nothing else works for kids. There's a ton of research, particularly for kids of color, about the power and the impact of having a teacher who shares their racial identity. There's a ton of research about teacher quality, like Bernadia mentioned, and having a high-impact teacher for several years in a row that have high impacts on student learning. And then I disagree with the second half around there's no way that a, quote, segregated environment can be successful, because I don't think that we have evidence of that in Minnesota, that that's not true. We have evidence of schools, some of them charter schools, who serve minority populations and do so well. And they're the schools that end up on the beating of the odds list. Those are the schools that are outperforming what's expected for low-income kids of color.
And there are there's some public schools as well.
Absolutely.
Like, look at Lucy Laney.
Absolutely.
And look at schools in Minneapolis, Lindale. They're doing great jobs as well.
Dan, what's the status of the lawsuit?
Status of the lawsuit is we're waiting for a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court, where the question is, can courts in Minnesota decide whether kids are getting an adequate education? And is Minnesota going to be the first state to say that a segregated education can be an equal and adequate education?
So the solution, Dad, the solution is to go to citywide transportation?
Well, that depends.
Oh.
It depends on how the case comes out.
Okay.
If we win the case, as I hope we will, and it's got to go back for trial. So we have to prove the schools are segregated, the education's inadequate. If the court finds that, then what the court does is it says to the legislature, this is a segregated, unlawful, inadequate education, fix the problem.
Hey, I thank you all for a really insightful and lively roundtable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brandy, Dan, thank you.